The interesting thing and troubling thing about this story of the man born blind in John chapter 9, for me anyway, is that outside of the man born blind and Jesus, everybody else in this story, whether it's the disciples or the Pharisees or the man's neighbors, they are the ones with the true blindness. And the man born blind and Jesus are the only ones who see what's really going on correctly and properly. Some of the people in John chapter 9 are totally blind. The Pharisees get so caught up in this miracle and in Jesus' power that they can't celebrate with the man born blind. They interrogate him about who's been doing these unauthorized healings. And they can't give thanks to God for something magnificent and marvelous. The disciples, whose sight is dimmed, it's fortunately dimmed, they're not totally blind, but hampered, they don't see fully what's going on here either. It's only Jesus and the man born blind who can see. And the reason I find this troubling is because I believe, if I'm understanding the Gospel of John correctly, John is saying that we're all damaged. We're all hampered. We're all sinful and held back. And sometimes we think of ourselves, well, if I'm not blind, if I don't have a disability, if I'm not disabled or diseased, then I'm in good shape. But John is saying exactly the opposite, that we're held back by our own sin. We're held back by our own pride and our intelligence. We're held back by who we have created ourselves to be. So first off, I want to notice very carefully and closely the contrast that John sets up here between the man born blind and the disciples. It starts right at the beginning of the story. The disciples see this man who is born blind. Perhaps he's out begging in the street because that's the only kind of work that he can have. That's the only thing that he is able to do with his total blindness. And notice what happens. Rather than trying to help, rather than saying, Jesus, can we do something? Or Jesus, can you do something? They start a theological discussion. They right away start a questionable discussion. Rabbi, who sinned? Was it this man himself who was born with this terrible blindness? Or was it his parents? Because it would be kind of odd for him to sin since he hadn't been born yet. Or was it his parents who sinned, and this is God's punishment upon the parents for being sinful people? In other words, they ask, whose fault is it that this man is born blind? So rather than do what you would expect the disciples to do, Jesus, we've got a man born blind here. You know, you've turned the water into wine. You have caused the lame to walk. You have caused many remarkable things to happen. Rather than that, they start out asking, who's to blame, Jesus? Who's to blame? And the contrast is made all the more powerful when you realize that on the other hand, the man born blind, he accepts Jesus' command without a word. Let me read to you this again, what happens. Jesus spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, put it on the man's eyes. Go, Jesus told him, wash in the pool of Siloam, this word which means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. The man accepts Jesus' command without a word. This man who has lived his whole life in darkness, who has lived his whole existence sightless, he accepts without a word that he can go and wash and he will be healed. It's not at all what we would expect to happen, really, because I would bet that this man had many treatments, had tried to become sighted, had gone to many doctors. I'm sure he had gone to many healers, that he had hoped that he would regain his sight throughout his life, and it had never happened. And so what we would expect him to say is, oh yeah, sure, I've heard that before. This is a likely story, I'll see. I've been here before. I've heard the promises made. There should be some frustration of this man who since birth has never been able to see. some questioning of Jesus. And yet, the man born blind accepts it on faith, and he is healed. And the reason I find this so terrifying is that you and I think we know so much better than Jesus does. At least we think we do. We think we see things so clearly. But what does Jesus warn us about? Jesus warns us in the Sermon on the Mount, watch out when you're pointing out the speck in your brother's eye because you've got the log in your own eye. Matthew chapter 7, verse 4. One of my favorite authors is a man named John Lex. He teaches English at Houghton College in upstate New York. And he tells a story about visiting several years ago now, Opryland. I think Opryland is closed. I don't think you can go there any longer. And I guess it was back in the late 80s or 90s. And he talks about visiting Opryland and the big convention center they had, and the big hotel they had. And there were these interior gardens that had been immaculately groomed. And John Lex is something of a gardener himself. And they've got, or they had, a 40-foot tall mountain where you could stand on top of the mountain and overlook the whole garden and a waterfall. And John Lex found himself annoyed by the whole spectacle in the garden, this interior garden. And the reason he found it annoying was because he said it was like a garden without any gardening. It was climate controlled. They had the perfect humidity set. Everything was perfect. There were no predators to any of these plants. And John Lex was saddened by this interior garden because it was like a gigantic terrarium. It wasn't a real garden like one you had to work on with your own hands and where the deer could come in out of the forest. And I think you know what I'm talking about here in Murraysville. It happens all the time. And he's sad because he says, you know, this is trying to create something that's artificial. This is trying to create something that's intellectually laid out, but its results are sterile. And for John Lex, this was a problem because he would much rather see a garden that accepts gardening on God's rules, gardening in God's times, where thorns can grow up and choke off your plants, where other animals can come by, where pests are a real danger to your garden, and where you have to get down and get your hands dirty. But this instead is garden in a box. And look at how we have put God and nature into a box, how God has resisted and nature has resisted our attempts to manage and overrule them. Several years ago, I remember reading an article in one of the magazines, whether it was Time or Newsweek, about people who had moved to Arizona because of their terrible allergies from the Northeast, so from around here. And these folks who moved to Arizona, they wanted to go and get this breath of desert air because a lot of the plants that have dander and that kind of stuff, a lot of the plants that have pollen don't grow very well or don't grow naturally in Arizona. But what happened was when people moved, they looked out and they said, you know, this doesn't look at all like home. I've got to bring some plants with me so that I feel a little bit more comfortable. And then all of a sudden they've decorated a little bit of home. And now if you go to Arizona and you suffer from hay fever, you may very well still suffer from hay fever in Arizona. It's not the same paradise that it once was for those of us who suffer from allergies. And it's the same story with zebra mussels in the St. Lawrence Seaway that have come from Russia. Zebra mussels are not native to North America. They came from Russian boats that came down the St. Lawrence Seaway and now have deposited zebra mussels up and down the Great Lakes corridor. And another local thing, what about stink bugs? Anybody have problems with stink bugs in Murraysville? They came from produce from Asia somewhere and they arrived probably in Allentown. And they came because you and I all like produce from Asia, things grown in Asia that we can't grow here in the good old US of A. Notice how nature sort of gets the last laugh sometimes. Nature is out of our control, even if we think we're controlling it. And we're too quick, like the disciples, to analyze than we are to see. It's much easier to analyze a problem than to fix it. In Truman Capote's book, Breakfast at Tiffany's, that the heroine in that book is called Holly Golightly, and she goes through all of these different adventures, these little minor things in New York City that happen to her, and she has a friend who she calls Fred, and he is her friend, and he learns things about Holly Golightly, and the one thing that causes him when he first meets her is on the card at the mailbox in their apartment building. It says, Holly Golightly, traveler. That's how she introduces herself to people, because she's never at home anywhere she lives. When he goes up to her apartment, there are boxes everywhere. It looks like somebody has just moved in and she's been there for months. And Holly Golightly, as it turns out, as you read the book a little bit more and deeper, you find out, first of all, that's not even her real name. She was from the South somewhere, and she had a name like Lulabelle or something like that. And she is fleeing a life from her family and from the South. And after she had fled the South, she went to Hollywood, and she tried to make it there, and she fled Hollywood. And then she comes to New York City, and she tried to make a life there, and she fled after the story is over, and she goes somewhere else. And she is constantly trying to escape whatever constraints are put upon her. It's easier to analyze the problem than to see what the solution is. We realize as we read the book that Holly Golightly is kind of tragic because she doesn't have any place. She doesn't have any friends that are permanent. She doesn't have any place that's permanent. And the problem is easy to analyze. Perhaps she's depressed or she's going through some sort of wanderlust. She wants to find out who she is. She wants to find herself, or suffocating boredom with things that get routine. But what's the solution? And the book is open-ended. We don't know. How would you solve her desire to find a home when she feels entirely homeless? It's the same thing with forgiveness. It's much easier to analyze it than to see the solution. I know many places in my life where forgiveness is needed, where I need to either ask for it or give it. Yet it's much harder to actually do that. I think it was Mark Twain who once said that everybody thinks forgiveness is a great and fantastic idea until you have somebody that you have to forgive. So before we get too smug, before we pity the blind man because he's disabled, we have to realize that we're the blind man. We're the one. Before we pity the blind man, we have to realize that we're the ones who have the problems, that we are the ones who maybe we don't see Jesus at all. Maybe the woman with depression or the family raising a child with a mental difficulty may see Jesus better than I do. So before I start to think that I'm the one who's whole, I have to ask myself, who am I really in this story? I think it was Will Willimon, who's one of the finest preachers in the English language, talked about a new group of people coming into seminary. And they all came into seminary in a new class, and you have to do this in seminary. I did it too. You introduce yourselves to the professors and to your class, and in small little groups. And you give testimony of how it was that you got to seminary. And people were talking about how God got them to seminary. And Will Willimon couldn't wait to hear Carol's story, because Carol was a chief financial officer of a large company, and she had given up a seven-figure income to come to seminary. And after story of dramatic and powerful testimony of how God had touched people's lives, healings, or alcoholics who had permanently given up the bottle, or people who had felt the call of God while they were doing the dishes and they were struck dumb by the call of God and by the power of God in that moment, Will Willimon could not wait to hear what had caused Carol to turn her back on this major company and go into seminary and to serve God. Carol was the last of the group. And so when they finally got to her testimony, Will Willimon couldn't wait to hear what she was going to say. And she said this. She said, one day she realized that she was blind. Blind not in the literal sense, but blind in the spiritual sense to what life was all about. So she sat down at her computer terminal, wrote her two-week notice, said her goodbyes, got a very nice going away party, and enrolled in seminary. And Will Willimon said, what, that's it? That's the story? And Carol replied, yeah, that's it. You kind of had to be there. And I think in many ways, that's how we're made whole and healed. Sometimes it's dramatic, like the man born blind. Yet for the disciples and the Pharisees and the neighbors, it's kind of not that dramatic. They were healed too. The disciples were. And, some of the neighbors were healed as well, but it wasn't nearly as dramatic. It wasn't a headline-grabbing kind of healing. So my encouragement today is when you ask if you are whole, well, you just kind of had to be there. Amen.